Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We're pleased today to have Michael Conti, MD, Co-Director of the Heart and Vascular Center at UCSF, speaking on peripheral arterial disease. Dr. Conti is a vascular surgeon and co-director of the UCSF Heart and Vascular Center and Chief of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery. He specializes in diseases of the aorta and major branches, aneurysms, carotid artery disease, and peripheral arterial disease. He also treats diabetic vascular disease and performs complex revascularization to preserve limb function and prevent amputation. Dr. Conti led the largest multi-center clinical trial to date examining leg bypass surgery in patients with severe PAD and is studying angioplasty and bypass surgery failure and approaches to identify patients at risk. Dr. Conti earned a medical degree at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. He completed a surgical residency at New York Hospital, Cornell Medical Center, and vascular surgery training as a John Homans Fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and Harvard Medical School. He is a member of the Society for Vascular Surgery and Society of University Surgeons. In 2006, he received the Distinguished Achievement Award from the New York Weill Cornell Medical Center Alumni Council. He serves on the editorial boards for vascular and endovascular surgery, vascular medicine, Journal of Vascular Surgery, and vascular. So, Dr. Conti.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to be here tonight, and thank you, all of you, for coming for what I hope will be an interesting and at least somewhat stimulating conversation on a problem that I deal with on an everyday basis. By way of introduction, I am, as Bill pointed out, a vascular surgeon, which is a specialty that deals with the care of patients with diseases of their blood vessels, the highways, if you will, that carry the circulation from the heart throughout the body. And the diseases we treat are things like aneurysms, which are enlargements of arteries, blockages of arteries, or peripheral artery disease, which we'll talk about tonight, and problems that problems in the veins and problems that cause stroke. Tonight, I will talk to you about peripheral artery disease, and I've titled this The New Cardiovascular Epidemic, and it's really not new, but what it is silent. And what I'll hope to share with you tonight is why it's important, why it's becoming increasingly important both to us as individuals and to the public health in this country, and what kinds of things can be done to diagnose and treat it, and finally, where we stand on the cusp of research in this area. So my objectives are to, as I said, define its importance, understand the risk factors for peripheral artery disease, which I'll call PAD for this talk, understand how it presents in terms of clinical findings and manifestations for patients and what kinds of complications they may get from this disease, understand how it can be diagnosed in the office, and the research imperatives. So first, just so everyone understands what the problem is, peripheral artery disease is essentially a disease that manifests from blockages of the arteries in the limbs, and primarily we're talking about the legs. So the arteries are the vessels that carry blood down to the extremities, and when these arteries get blocked, this reduces blood flow to the limb and the foot. And the symptoms related to those blockages, which may or may not exist, depend on the location of those blockages and how severe they are. So first, just a little bit of perspective about cardiovascular disease in general, which is heart and vascular disease. Although a lot of great strides have been made in reducing death and disability from cardiovascular disease in the last two decades, it remains far and away the number one cause of deaths in the United States. It's responsible for twice as many deaths as all cancers combined. And what some people don't know is that half of all of these cardiovascular deaths are actually due to vascular disease outside of the heart. And that's diseases of the blood vessels, the vascular diseases, PAD, stroke, and aneurysms. A few other small facts just to put it into context. 10 times as many women today die from cardiovascular disease as from breast cancer. There are major racial and ethnic disparities in this disease, which we'll talk about briefly, not only in the disease and its occurrence and severity, but also in the outcomes from treatment. And cardiovascular research in general, in comparison to other diseases based on the number of patients that are stricken, remains relatively underfunded. More specifically to our topic tonight, peripheral artery disease is a major manifestation of atherosclerosis in the body, that is, diseases of the blood vessels related to plaque development and deposits of cholesterol in the vessels. It's estimated that as many as 10 to 12 million Americans currently have PAD, and the diagnosis of PAD, which we'll come to in a number of ways, its importance, but it's really critical because it's similar in terms of prognosis to being diagnosed with a heart attack. So while this may be the first symptom of vascular disease in the body, it's equal in its prognostic significance to having a coronary artery blockage. This disease is increasing because of the increasing age of our population, the continued prevalence of smoking, and most recently the dramatic increases in the risk factors of diabetes and obesity, which many of you are well aware of in our population. As I mentioned, PAD affects minority populations disproportionately to their other risk factors, and it may be the very first sign of a cardiovascular problem. And large studies in primary care practices have clearly shown that this disease is being underdiagnosed and undertreated broadly in the community. This diagnosis carries important implications to the patient, both for their limb, which is affected by the blood flow reduction, and also for their life, because it's a manifestation of general disease throughout the heart and blood vessels. There's anywhere from 2 to actually 6-fold increased risk for heart disease and stroke in patients with PAD. And in terms of the leg itself, this disease can lead to severe disability, loss of function, and even in the worst case, loss of the limb itself. The number of cases has been rising, and the number of treatments has been rising, and the economic burden, therefore, in our health system is growing significantly. The estimated costs in 2004 were $21 billion in Medicare expenditures for the treatment of PAD in hospitalized patients. That doesn't account for all the outpatient treatments, and that estimate is already 5 or 6 years old. There are still roughly 80,000 or more major amputations performed a year for vascular disease, and currently there are an estimated 1.4 million Americans living with major limb loss from this disease. Now, fortunately, there is a growing public awareness to this problem because of several foundations and coalitions that have been working to increase public awareness. The PAD Coalition is one such foundation that has been doing some advertising. Some of you may have seen some of their ads at night on television. Also, some of the drug companies have begun to educate the population about this disease. And so I think patients more often are coming to my office having at least heard the term PAD. And in order to make people understand that this is an important problem, we have to, in a sense, scare them a little bit about how significant this is. And this ad is a little bit scary. It talks about PAD as no walk in the park because of its relationship to serious problems, heart attack, stroke, amputation, and even death. And this one may be a little more striking, posing the risk of limb loss for patients who have PAD reaching a critical stage if it goes untreated. What causes PAD is atherosclerosis, the same disease that causes so-called hardening of the arteries in the heart and in the brain. It's a disease that takes years to build up. When patients actually get diagnosed with PAD, they've already had this process taking place for decades. It did not just begin that day. Plaque, cholesterol, fatty deposits builds up in the wall over time and ultimately reaches a point where it creates severe narrowing or complete blockages of one or more arteries in the leg, resulting in decreasing blood flow. So who's at risk for PAD? The key risk factors are shown on this slide. It's a disease that is certainly concentrated in patients greater than 50 years of age, and its risk dramatically increases with each decade of age, which we'll get into shortly. Smoking and diabetes are the two strongest risk factors outside of age. Smoking, of course, is a modifiable one, but not one that's easily corrected in my own practice. Despite seeing patients with the most severe problems, it remains a difficult habit to break, but one that's important for reducing the burden of cardiovascular disease. Diabetes, of course, is not a disease that anyone chooses to get, but it's a big risk factor for PAD. And in the presence of diabetes, PAD takes on an entirely different and more aggressive manifestation. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, and obesity are also risk factors. But I want to make sure that everyone understands that although we know the risk factors for PAD, even people who don't have these risk factors can get it. And certainly, I've had a number of patients much younger in age, young women at all stages of life, stricken with PAD for no apparent reason. And therefore, it's important for everyone to understand the nature of this disease. In terms of the prevalence of PAD, it's clearly very related to age. This slide summarizes several large population epidemiology studies showing the prevalence, that is, the proportion of individuals in the population who have PAD based on a simple diagnostic test, which I will show you, a measurement of the blood pressure in the limb. And if you look here, based on the population, starting at age greater than 40 years, about 4.3% of the U.S. population, and then going up to studies that focused on patients older than 55 or in their 60s, up to as many as 20% of patients. And in one large primary care practice study, the PARTNER study, they looked at patients who were either greater than 70 or had at least one risk factor and screened them with a diagnostic test. And in those patients who had no symptoms, I would add, roughly 30% of them were found to have PAD. So this is a disease that increases dramatically as we get older, and it's highly prevalent in the older population and those with risk factors. And this prevalence is rising, and it's rising in an interesting fashion, in some ways disproportionate to different groups. We've seen it increasing particularly in women. We've seen it increasing dramatically in African-American citizens and African-American males especially. And relatively speaking, over the last decade, there's roughly 20% increase in the apparent prevalence of the disease. And it's felt that this is probably mostly due to the epidemic of obesity, diabetes, and what we're calling the metabolic syndrome, which is an inflammatory, systemic manifestation of obesity and diabetes that affects the blood vessels and other organs. This shows a little bit more dramatically how PAD rises with age. It's a disease that affects mostly patients over the age of 60. And at the younger ages, it is predominantly a male disease. Once we get into the postmenopausal age ranges, after a decade or two postmenopausal, the female prevalence starts to catch up. And because women in general outlive men, the dominant population in the 80s with PAD is actually becoming a female population. So men and women are, as I said, both affected, and you can see on this slide looking at a large series that actually women predominate once you get into the mid and upper 80s when we look at the diagnosis of PAD in primary care physicians' offices. And you can see that in that age range it's approaching 15 to 16% in this study. I mentioned that there's a rather dramatic ethnic disparity and racial disparity which has been observed. It's not explained solely by disproportionate risk factors like diabetes or smoking or hypertension. It appears there are some unexplained racial and ethnic differences in this disease, and not only its occurrence but also its severity. African-American patients have a higher rate of this disease even when correcting for all these other factors. And they also significantly have a higher rate of limb loss when treated, despite correcting for many other factors. So they appear to get a more virulent form of the disease more commonly for reasons that we don't as yet understand. In looking at the relative strength of these different risk factors, as I mentioned, by far smoking and diabetes are the most potent risk factors. High blood pressure and high cholesterol are also risk factors, but they're slightly weaker. And a blood test, the elevation of C-reactive protein, has also turned out to be a marker for PAD, as it is a marker for heart disease and even for the risk of stroke. So inflammation, manifestations of inflammation in the body, which C-reactive protein is a way of measuring general inflammation state of the body. is a risk factor for developing cardiovascular disease in general and peripheral artery disease specifically. Diabetes is a really important risk factor for PAD, not only because it increases the risk of PAD when people have overt diabetes, but even when they have so-called pre-diabetes or an abnormal single glucose test, they are at a higher risk for developing PAD. And the importance of PAD in diabetes really can't be overemphasized. We'll talk about it a little bit more later in the evening, but diabetes is a very potent risk factor for predicting the severity of this disease and its consequences. So all diabetics need to be particularly aware of their leg circulation and reduce their chances of developing PAD and get it treated and monitored promptly. So to summarize all this information, and based on the epidemiology that I showed you, some expert panels have defined an at-risk group that might benefit from screening for this disease. And that group includes patients less than 50 years old who have diabetes or at least one other risk factor, like smoking, elevated cholesterol, or high blood pressure, those between the ages of 50 and 69 with smoking or diabetes, all patients who are 70 years and older, and anyone who has any symptoms possibly of PAD, which includes pain in the legs with walking or exertion, or pain at rest in the foot, what we call ischemic rest pain, anybody who has absent pulses in their feet or an abnormal vascular examination, and patients who've already had other evidence of blood vessel or heart diseases affecting the heart, the brain, or other vessels. So many patients who have PAD don't have any symptoms at all and are entirely unaware of their disease, and it's important to diagnose it, not only because it has implications for the limb, but also, as I mentioned, because it indicates the need for treatment of their overall vascular disease to avoid significant heart and vascular complications. The symptoms that people can get, the classic ones are pain in the legs with walking, which is called claudication. This pain is typically described as occurring with a given amount of exercise, and it's relieved with rest, and we'll go through a little bit of that shortly. When the disease gets more severe and the reduction in the circulation is even more significant, one can get pain in the foot even without exercise or pain at rest. This implies that there's barely enough circulation to sustain the needs of the foot and the extremity. That's called critical limb ischemia, or CLI. And at that stage, when it gets even more severe, one can have more overt manifestations such as open sores that fail to heal, ulcers, or the development of gangrene, which is essentially the death of skin and tissue, blackened tissue, which is a manifestation of essentially dying back of the tissues of the foot. So we mentioned who should be tested for PAD. Certainly people who fall into those population categories we mentioned have a higher incidence of having PAD, and so testing that population has a higher predictive value, and patients who've had previous heart and vascular diseases. But I should point out that it's a little bit controversial about screening for PAD in the population at large. In fact, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which looks at questions of screening and cost-effectiveness, so far has not recommended screening for PAD in the general population because of concerns about overtreatment, which we can talk about a little bit later as well. What the American Heart Association and other vascular societies are recommending is similar to what's on this slide, that in a targeted population, we believe screening for that disease is appropriate, but this remains an area of ongoing controversy. It's relatively simple to diagnose this disease in the office. A 5-minute bedside test can tell, in most cases, if there is peripheral artery disease, and the test involves simply measuring the blood pressure in the legs with a blood pressure cuff placed at the ankle and a simple ultrasound instrument called a Doppler to listen to blood flow, and comparing that blood pressure to the blood pressure in the arm. And this creates what we call the ankle brachial index, which is a ratio of your arm pressure to your ankle pressure. And in normal people, this should be one or even greater than one. And when that ratio is reduced to 0.9 or less, that's considered to fit the diagnosis of peripheral artery disease. And the severity of the disease is also, as you might imagine, quantitatively linked to the reduction in the ABI. So the lower the ABI, the lower the circulation to the leg. In general, that correlates with a greater degree of symptoms. And when that ratio gets down under 0.4, that's usually the critical level for reaching that CLI category of more advanced disease. Now, some patients cannot get that test done accurately because their blood vessels are actually so hardened that they don't compress under a blood pressure cuff, and you can't actually get the blood pressure cuff to work on the ankle. This is typically the case in patients who've had longstanding diabetes or patients who have kidney disease who have very, very calcified, very hard arteries. In those cases, sometimes we have to use other tests. We can actually measure the pressure in the digits of the foot, in the toes, which are generally not affected by that calcium process. And so another way of obtaining the diagnosis in most vascular labs, this may not be available in everybody's primary care office, is to measure pressures actually in the toe and derive a toe-to-arm index. Sometimes when the ABI value is either normal or borderline, but the patient has very compelling symptoms of leg pain when they walk, it may be possible that they have PAD, but it's not brought out on the test that's done at rest. And in those cases, the gold standard test is to do a treadmill examination where we measure the ABI at rest and then with exercise. And if the patient has PAD, we expect that that ABI will drop when they have pain walking on the treadmill to prove that it's the circulation that's the problem. Because PAD is not the only thing that causes leg pain with walking, in some cases it's important to do this test. Some of the other common things that can cause leg pain are spine disease and arthritis, which I'll talk about in a couple of minutes. Other tests that are commonly done in physicians' offices to not only diagnose PAD but to create treatment plans include other types of imaging, including ultrasound, which is a non-invasive tool readily available in most offices and certainly most multi-specialty clinics. Ultrasound is a very important tool for the diagnosis of blood vessel disease, especially in the legs, where it's very easy to image the arteries because they're not that deep from the skin. And not only can you demonstrate where there are blockages, but you can actually determine the severity of those blockages and in some cases plan the appropriate treatment based on an ultrasound study. Other types of imaging tests to demonstrate the location of blockages include CAT scans and MRIs, or magnetic resonance imaging. These are both relatively non-invasive tests, and sometimes they require an intravenous to administer some contrast. And what you can see on this slide of an MR angiogram from a patient is that you can get very nice pictures of the blood vessels. Here you can see the main blood vessels from the abdomen all the way down to below the knees. This is a normal examination by MRI without requiring any really invasive procedure. Now, these tests are really only useful after establishing that the disease is present and determining what type of treatment might be appropriate if somebody has significant symptoms. They're not really used simply to screen you for the disease, and they're not required in all patients. The next important point that I want to bring out is the implications for life of making this diagnosis, and they are significant. This slide shows how the diagnosis of having PAD and its symptoms correlates with mortality. PAD, like coronary artery disease and like stroke, has a significant implication for mortality, mostly related to other cardiovascular events. So even patients who do not have symptoms, as you can see on this slide, asymptomatic PAD patients have a markedly reduced survival over 5 to 10 years compared to age-matched control subjects who don't have PAD. And as you go up the scale with the severity of the PAD, the more severe the disease in the leg, the increased mortality is evident on this slide. And you can see from this slide, in terms of the causes of death, that most of the causes of death in patients with PAD are related to either cerebrovascular disease, as in stroke, or a coronary heart disease, both at least several-fold higher than any other cause of death in the population with PAD. So people with PAD die of heart attacks and strokes, and even patients who don't even know they have heart disease, if their first manifestation is the disease in the leg, may be at high risk for those problems. In fact, this is a study that was done a number of years ago, a large study looking at the risk for various types of cardiovascular events in patients with either PAD, disease in the legs, CVD, cerebrovascular disease or stroke, or CAD, coronary artery disease, disease of the arteries of the heart. And what it shows you is that the risk for any major cardiovascular event, the highest risk group of all those groups is the PAD group. In fact, the risk of any of these cardiovascular events is higher with PAD than it is for patients who are diagnosed with coronary artery disease. And I mentioned that that ABI test not only correlates, tells us if you have the disease, but correlates with symptoms, it also correlates with survival. So the lower that ABI test, the more the increased risk of death is evident. You can see that as you get below the normal value of 1, the mortality rate starts to increase going to the left. And actually, as you go above 1.3, which indicates the vessels are becoming so hard that they don't actually compress under the cuff, the mortality also starts to go up. So the ABI test, a very simple test, actually correlates and predicts long-term survival. And that's also shown on this slide. Once you get under a value of 0.7, the cardiovascular event rate rises dramatically. And I would point out that those of you who may be familiar with the Framingham Risk Index, which is a way that you can calculate your long-term risk of cardiovascular death and disability, there's a website where you can enter your information and get a calculation. These numbers of risk related to PAD of 2 to 4% within 5 years are the highest risk group from Framingham. So having this diagnosis correlates with being in the highest risk, which in the Framingham study is 20% risk at 10 years. It's you're in the high risk group if you have PAD. So I mentioned that most patients actually with PAD, as picked up by the test, don't actually have any symptoms at all. Probably half of the patients don't have any symptoms. About 20 to 30% have some type of leg pain. Only a proportion of those really have classical symptoms that we described as pain in the calf or thigh with exercise. Others have different descriptions of leg pain that doesn't always fit that exact classical description. And only a small fraction, perhaps 3% or less, actually first present in the office with the most severe signs, which is the critical limb ischemia stage where the foot is really at risk and in danger. So by and large, that group is really the tip of the iceberg, and below that there's a huge population of people who are developing this disease, and many of them don't even know that they have it. We mentioned already that the prognosis is important because of risk to life. I want to point out that those who have no symptoms or very mild symptoms, the risk of losing their leg is actually very, very low. So patients who are without symptoms or just have walking pain, the risk to the limb is only about 1% per year of amputation. But the risk of mortality is 5% per year. So it's a disease where we're more worried actually at the outset about the overall picture of the health of the patient than specifically about avoiding loss of the limb. Over time, about 20 to 30% will progress enough in their leg to require some type of procedure to improve blood flow within 5 years. And only a small fraction develop this most severe form, critical limb ischemia, which requires really prompt attention to avoid losing the leg. So beyond the patients who have no symptoms, we mentioned that walking pain, or what's called claudication, is the really classic symptom of early or developing PAD. And it's a pain that occurs in the leg with exercise. It's described classically as being very predictable in terms of the distance required and the amount of exercise. Patients know exactly how far they can go before they get it. It doesn't change from day to day. It's very consistent. When they stop walking, it goes away quickly, generally within minutes, and it doesn't vary very much. It's not brought on by other things like simply standing at the sink for a long period of time or standing after sitting in a car for a long time. Those can be symptoms of other types of leg pain, for example, related to disease of the spine. The location of the pain, whether it's in the upper part of the leg or the lower part of the leg, is a reflection of where the level of blockage in the artery is. So typically, when you have pain in your calf muscle, it usually reflects a blockage in the artery in the thigh or one joint level above. And similarly, pain in the thigh or hip usually reflects a blockage in the vessels leading down to the leg in the abdomen, which are called the aortoiliac vessels. And it's important to understand that we can make this diagnosis in majority of cases without doing a lot of sophisticated tests. A good history in the office, a good physical exam, and some very simple non-invasive studies such as I showed you within a 15 to 20 minute interview can generally establish this diagnosis and also have a pretty good idea of how severe it is and where it's likely to be. Patients who are at this stage who are now having actual symptoms from their PAD or claudication also have, you know, an important message to hear about the risk to life, again, primarily from heart attack, as shown on this slide. Survival is reduced over time. The risk of amputation, which is the lowest curve on this slide, is very low. So the most important message I try to get across to patients who first show up with this problem is let's control those risk factors. Stop smoking. Let's get the diabetes, the blood pressure, and the cholesterol under control. This is a sign that you have cardiovascular disease at risk for major events, and your immediate risk for your leg is actually very low. If things progress or move on to become greater levels of disability, treatment specific to the leg may be required. But this is the big message that they need to understand, really what's shown on this slide. I mentioned that not all leg pain is PAD, and many of these other problems are also problems that we get more frequently as we get older, so it's not uncommon that patients will come in with all different types of leg pain. And spine disease is very common as a cause of leg pain. It can cause leg pain with walking. Typically, it also causes pain related to just changing your position, like rising suddenly from a long car ride or standing too long in one place. Other types of nerve-related problems include neuropathy, sometimes related to diabetes or other causes, which can cause pain in the limb. Certainly arthritis of the hips and knee joints and even feet is common in the elderly population and can cause difficulty with ambulation. And there are various other things, including benign muscle cramping and restless leg syndrome, that patients will come in complaining of, concerned that it's their circulation. And in many of those cases, it's not related at all to circulation. But it may be appropriate to at least get a vascular exam and an ABI test to evaluate that. As I mentioned, the key features of specifically PAD-related leg pain, it's described often as a cramping, an aching, a tightness, or a fatigue occurring with exercise. It usually occurs in the major muscle groups, not in the foot itself, the calf, the thigh, or buttock. It is exercise-dependent. It generally doesn't occur at rest unless it's very, very advanced, and then in that case it would be in the foot alone, mostly. It's consistent in the amount of exercise that brings it on, and it's quickly relieved generally by rest. The more severe stage of the disease is critical limb ischemia. This is when the reductions in blood flow have reached a very advanced state, and if this is not treated with some method of improving the circulation, patients are at high risk for losing their limb in the near term, within months or less. Signs of this can be patients describing pain even at rest in their feet or toes, sometimes requiring them to get up out of bed and dangle their feet at night. They literally need gravity to improve the blood flow reaching their toes. They can develop some advanced visible signs, such as discoloration, bluish or black discoloration of the toes, or even open sores. And at this point in the disease, prompt referral and prompt treatment generally requires procedures to improve blood flow. to salvage and preserve the limb. Some of the more dramatic physical signs are discoloration, as I mentioned, shown on this slide, some open wounds that don't heal even after minor foot surgery. You can have, even slower than that, you can see the development of shiny skin, loss of hair and nail growth, and various other early manifestations. So now I want to turn to treatment and what the goals of treatment are once establishing a diagnosis, and separate the two major goals, which are, one is the global overall goal, which is to reduce cardiovascular events once we've determined that you have PAD. The goal is to decrease the mortality and morbidity from heart attack and stroke. And then separately, how to improve the outcomes for the limb, how to improve the disability, reduce the disability, improve quality of life for patients who are limited by their exercise capacity, and how to prevent the progression to that more advanced stage of critical limb ischemia and amputation. And also an important goal is to reduce pain, heal wounds, and in general improve quality of life and function. So the general treatment starts with controlling those risk factors. And the first and foremost one that is modifiable behavior is smoking. Every effort needs to be made to stop smoking by whatever means available. There are all sorts of options today that may be helpful, including nicotine replacement, medications, hypnotism, behavior modification. Most of them have a high rate of recidivism, unfortunately, but clearly we as physicians need to do everything possible to reiterate this message at every turn. Diet and lifestyle changes are also important to control cholesterol and encourage exercise. Exercise in general in the PAD patient is not only not harmful, but it's good for their heart and also good for their circulation. We encourage patients to exercise as much as they can. And controlling their glucose is important also for their global health for those patients who have diabetes or prediabetes. In terms of medications, the recommendations for PAD are quite similar to patients with heart disease. That is, in order to reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke in this population, aspirin and aspirin-related drugs have a proven effect, at least in patients with the symptomatic forms of the disease. Cholesterol-lowering drugs such as statins have been shown to reduce mortality in this population fairly dramatically, and so they are now considered a standard of care. And also for those patients who have high blood pressure or diabetes, medications specific to control those conditions to within guidelines are appropriate. In terms of the leg itself, for patients who present with claudication, the early stage of disease, in addition to stopping smoking and controlling their risk factors, we encourage patients to walk. Exercise, and particularly supervised exercise, has been shown to improve walking ability over time. We'll show a little bit of that data. And so getting patients to walk every day in a reproducible place where there's not a lot of hills, perhaps with a friend or buddy, is very helpful. Medications for this condition are really, there aren't that many. The one medication that has had some demonstrable effect at improving walking function is called cilostazol. Its trade name is Pletol. We'll show some of that data. It may improve walking function in some patients. The effects are actually relatively modest, but it is the one of two FDA-approved drugs that is commonly used for this condition. It's really important to understand that most patients with PAD do not require invasive procedures. Even if there is a blocked artery in the leg, it often does not require direct treatment because the limb is actually not at risk in the near term. So most patients, we really perform long-term surveillance, risk factor modification, medical therapy. But those who have more advanced symptoms or disease clearly benefit from procedures that are done to either open or bypass these vessels. And most importantly, this is a long-term management disease. This is a conversation that goes on between the patient and the physician for years. Surveillance and targeted appropriate interventions are what's important, not one-time solutions. So a dedicated vascular specialist is critical for the management of this disease. So what about walking? How much can walking help? People often ask, will I hurt myself if I walk? The answer is, in relation to this disease, no. But if you have, obviously, if you have significant unstable heart disease, or if you have other conditions that can be affected by walking, such as arthritis or spine disease, those things would need to be cleared by your other physicians. Studies that have looked at the effects of exercise training in a supervised setting have generally shown significant increases in the range of 100 to 200% of improvement in walking time on a treadmill or walking distance on a treadmill compared with patients who are treated with medications alone. So exercise does appear to work. The problem is that it's only been shown for supervised exercise, and the effect may not be durable once patients fail to continue with the program. Interestingly, the effects of exercise in some studies have been shown to be as good or better than angioplasty, opening up the vessel. And this is controversial, but there are studies going on right now in the United States to examine whether or not exercise is as effective, for example, as stenting of arteries that are blocked, if the exercise can be carried out and executed in a long-term durable fashion. So exercise can work, but the two big problems are keeping the patients in a program, and currently it's not reimbursed by Medicare. And this is also an area of a lot of active legislative efforts to get reimbursement not only for screening but for physical therapy related to PAD. This slide summarizes the one piece of data I wanted to show you about medical therapy. I mentioned cilostazol as a drug that is approved. This is some of the data that resulted in its FDA approval. And it does result in statistically significant increases in pain-free or maximal walking distance, but the degree of improvement is actually, in general, less than what's obtained, certainly with interventions like bypass or angioplasty, and on a par with or even less than the studies looking at exercise. The drug is generally well-tolerated in most people, so it is sometimes tried as a first-line option, and if patients try it for 2 or 3 months and they find that they're getting an improvement, we leave them on it. If they haven't seen a real effect in 2 or 3 months, then we usually encourage them to stop it. Otherwise, it becomes a lifelong prescription. In the more advanced stage, critical limb ischemia, we mentioned patients are presenting now at rest with pain. It doesn't require exercise. They may be losing tissue in their foot. They're having open sores. This means the circulation is much more severely compromised. They're at high risk if they're not treated, and they also have a higher risk for mortality. And it's particular concerns I want to point out related to diabetes. Diabetes and PAD together are a very important combination because diabetes markedly by itself increases both the mortality risk and the amputation risk for the PAD patient. Nerve damage in diabetes is another significant problem. Neuropathy in the foot causes loss of sensation and also impaired resistance to trauma and infection, which contribute to foot problems. And then in the setting of poor circulation, infections and wounds occur that become difficult to heal. For that reason, it's very important that diabetics, all diabetics, and especially those with PAD, pay very careful attention to preventive foot care, have proper fitting shoes, avoid injuries, and are monitored preferably by a podiatrist several times a year. And if they do have PAD, they're also closely monitored by their vascular specialist because even a seemingly minor foot problem in a diabetic with PAD can rapidly become a severe limb-threatening problem. And this slide shows the kind of wounds that can develop on a diabetic who has nerve damage. This is a foot that was created an ulcer because a patient had a shoe that was too tight. They didn't feel the sensation in that shoe. A blister rapidly becomes an open sore, and an open sore then rapidly becomes one that doesn't heal. And so the nerve damage of diabetes greatly compounds the vascular problem, rapidly leading to severe problems in the foot. So finally, when patients have the most severe manifestations of the disease, what we do in vascular surgery is try to improve the circulation or revascularize that limb. So treatments to directly improve blood flow are what we do for patients who have critical ischemia and those who have the really disabling symptoms of claudication affecting their quality of life and failing these conservative measures. And today we have a lot of options for that, for revascularization, including an increasing array of catheter-type procedures like angioplasty, atherectomy, which is a way to remove plaque, and stents. And for patients who have more severe blockages, bypass surgery in the leg is a staple of care that provides effective solution for many patients. There is no one-size-fits-all for this disease. Not all patients are treated with the same approach, and I think it's a place where experience, careful judgment, and creativity is required to individualize not only the right treatment but the right time to treat these patients. And I think it's pretty clear from lots of centers of excellence that having a multidisciplinary group with vascular specialists, heart specialists, anesthesiologists focused on the care of these patients reduces their risk for complications after these procedures and improves their long-term outcomes. In terms of the limb itself, with revascularization, we can expect improvements in walking ability and a reduction in amputation risk for many patients. But the effectiveness and durability of these treatments, which are now very common, actually vary quite dramatically between treatments and between patients. So stents and bypass surgery have very different long-term outcomes. There are both patient and procedure-specific factors that correlate with the durability of these treatments. Overall, however, none of these treatments, you know, restores these blood vessels to the 20-year-old stage. All of these treatments eventually are prone to failures, and it's actually quite common for treatment failures to occur, requiring repeat procedures in up to 30 to 50% of patients after, in some cases, within the first couple of years. And so for this reason, this is not the type of procedure that you do and then you go away from that vascular specialist. This is a long-term commitment on the part of the patient and the physician to monitor the outcome and maintain the durability of the effectiveness of that solution with long-term surveillance. Angioplasty and stenting is a common procedure done for blockages in arteries all over the body, and particularly in the lower extremity. When the disease is relatively localized, it's the most favorable types of disease for this approach are when the artery is not completely blocked and when the extent of the disease is relatively localized. In these cases, we can reopen up the vessel with a balloon and in some cases prop it open with a metallic mesh, which is a stent, and improve the blood flow immediately with that type of procedure. The durability of these procedures is related to the response of the artery after the treatment. Scar tissue can form and grow back in the area of the balloon or the stent, and so these treatments need to be monitored and not infrequently may require repeat procedures. Surgical treatments are often done for patients who have the more significant blockages, as I pointed out, complete blockages or longer blockages. In these cases, what we're doing is creating a new route for blood flow around the blocked artery in the leg. It's a similar same concept as bypass surgery in the heart. The best way to do this is to use a vein from your own limb. Generally, the vein in your leg is the best vein to use for bypass surgery in the heart or in the leg. Other types of materials can be used, such as man-made conduits, but they generally don't function quite as well as your own vein. The concept is shown on this cartoon to basically reroute the circulation and around the blockage. So I'll end by just saying that research in this area has really not received enough funding or attention in comparison to other types of cardiovascular disease and other diseases in general. And we who treat these patients day in and day out in increasing numbers recognize several major unmet research needs. And one of the main reasons that I'm here at the University of California in San Francisco is that this university has long been a leader in both the innovation and technology to develop new and effective treatments. The major needs that I've, in my mind, exist are, first of all, of course, to try to prevent the disease, which is atherosclerosis in general. So medications or prevention research is a primary need, but has been the holy grail of cardiovascular research for a very long time. We also could use more and better medicines to reduce symptoms. I mentioned there are only two drugs out there to improve walking pain, and their effects are relatively modest. Our areas of interest at UCSF include some of the other major needs that I mentioned on this slide. In particular, trying to improve the effectiveness and durability of these treatments that we do, such as angioplasty and stenting, new treatments to reduce the risk of scar tissue building back up to close down those stents and grafts so that patients can get one procedure that could last perhaps for life would be a great accomplishment. Also, we need research to better understand why some patients have a long-term success and other patients rapidly develop a re-narrowing of those arteries within months. We don't fully understand at all the variability in these responses between individuals. So we believe there's a role for understanding that better, perhaps by looking at the genetics between patients and other factors. Other important efforts include enhancing the body's innate ability to grow new blood vessels, to develop what we call collateral vessels around these blockages, either by using stem cells or regenerative medicine or perhaps genetic therapies to enhance the body's innate ability to deal with this problem. These research efforts are important, and the funding for these efforts are very important. I mentioned that in general, although there is a lot of cardiovascular research, of course, it is relatively underfunded in comparison to other diseases like cancer and HIV. And PAD research very specifically is grossly been underfunded by the federal government. There is recognition of that now, but it still remains in deficit. And for this reason, federal sources are not really the only solution for us. There's a growing need for both nonprofit and private foundations, as well as industry and other constituents. This bar graph shows the relative funding per patient. When you compare the amount of money that's spent on research for HIV and cancer to cardiovascular disease by the number of patients afflicted in the United States, you can see that per patient the funding is quite discrepant. So that leads me to conclude with a message about vascular cures, which is a foundation from the Bay Area that I am now serving on the board of. It's a foundation whose mission is to support research and the development of new innovation in vascular disease to prevent death and disability from this disorder. This foundation, which was started about 20 years ago, based on the efforts of several surgeons at UCSF, continues to function to support research and the careers of young investigators throughout the country, and has really been a source of both a great inspiration and direct research support for this work. And without them, I think we wouldn't be in the position we are today locally in this area, really standing at the threshold of new innovation and research to treat this disease. I thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much. Now we have time for questions. I'll pass the microphone around.
Hi there. Thanks for coming, and I appreciated your talk. I had a blood clot in my leg from a plane ride where I decided to watch three movies in a row, and I didn't get up and move around. And I think that the vein or artery kind of just died all the way down to my foot. Is that an indicator, or is there any kind of connection between PAD and that happening? I guess you understand the question. So.
Yeah, no, that's a different problem. That's called deep venous thrombosis, or DVT. In fact, I don't know in your case if it was a deep vein or a superficial vein. So that's a venous thrombosis, or a clot in a vein. Veins and the arteries are distinct. Of course, the arteries are what brings the blood down to the limb, critical for maintaining the survival of the tissue. The veins bring the blood back up towards the heart, and that there are many more veins and arteries. So losing a vein from a blood clot is not so critical often for the limb itself, but it can cause significant symptoms, and it can cause subsequent problems with swelling and skin changes in the leg. And most importantly, when those blood clots involve the deeper veins, they can cause life-threatening problems with breaking off of the clot traveling to the lung, which is pulmonary embolism. So those are related to the venous side of the circulation. The risk factors for venous problems and arterial problems are very different. Venous problems, like you described, blood clots, often occur when people are not active, have other illnesses or risk factors, like after surgery or hospitalized or a long plane ride can be such. Or sometimes people have an underlying predisposition, an abnormality in their clotting system. And we do suspect that more often when it's a young, healthy person getting one of these for no other reason, not after surgery or not after trauma. And so the treatment, you know, how long one needs to be on a blood thinner, the treatment is generally a blood thinner for some period of time. And then usually we like to see people wear some support on their legs, especially when they're in these situations like long plane rides, long car rides, because that's when the blood tends to sit in those veins and is at higher risk for clotting. Two separate problems, another type of vascular disease that we do treat, but very different from PAD, and they don't correlate.
One of the things that you talked about was cramping, particularly in the calf. As a person who's 75, I've had that on several occasions this spring, but it has been concurrent with long periods of time working upright in a kitchen as a volunteer chef. Is this something I need to go see my cardiologist about?
So, you know, we mentioned some of the cardinal features of leg pain that are suggestive of PAD. And obviously, if you have risk factors, whether it's age, smoking, diabetes, or others, the more risk factors you have, the more we want to make sure that you don't have PAD. Calf cramping can occur for a variety of reasons. It's most suggestive when it occurs with exercise. When it occurs at rest, you know, sitting on a couch or in a lounge chair, and it's kind of a Charlie horse feeling, a leg cramp, that's generally not a sign of PAD. When it occurs when you're standing still for too long, generally that's more often a sign of spine disease, narrowing of the spine, which can also cause leg pain. But I also showed you that people with PAD don't always have the typical symptoms. I showed you that some of them have atypical pain. So, and we can also have more than one problem. You know, as we get older, we can have both spine disease and PAD, and it can be hard to tell in some patients what's causing what. So if you have risk factors and if you have abnormal pulses and if it's a repetitive problem as opposed to a one-off event, I would get a vascular exam.
I know there hasn't been a whole lot of research, according to what you said, but just in your opinion, the prevalence that you tend to see in blacks with this, do you think that it could be somehow related to the prevalence of sickle cell trait in blacks, or just poor stress management, you know, and also, you know, a lot of things are really related to diet too. So
yeah,
I know there's a connection.
So first of all, I think there, in the black population in general, there is a higher proportion of some of those risk factors. So there is a higher proportion of smoking. There is a higher proportion of hypertension. So some of the disproportion may be due in part to having those other risk factors. But I also mentioned that it's not completely explainable by those. At least when you do the type of statistical modeling to try to account for that, it seems to still be excess. Most people suspect it probably has some other underlying socioeconomic source, such as potentially diet. And there's a variety of dietary theories ranging from vitamins to salt intake to other things. But we don't really know. And I think the research in this area has to go away from just describing it, which is what we've done for a while, you know, measuring the disparity, to trying to explain it. And that's a big leap. We really don't have a sense yet. You know, we're just beginning to start to get to some of the genetics of this problem. So it is possible that some ancestry issues, there may be some populations that maybe have a higher risk based on genetics. And it's a little hard to tease race and ethnicity because today many people have blended ancestry. So it makes it very complicated to look at race. Race is not a simple genetic problem. But that's where the research, I think, is going.
As I mentioned before your talk, My field of research is vitamin D, and it turns out that African Americans have a mean value about 16 nanograms per milliliter, white Americans about 26 nanograms per milliliter, and there's excellent observational studies with pre-diagnostic vitamin D studies for cardiovascular disease and diabetes, showing that there's about a 30% or so reduction in both of these diseases for higher levels of vitamin D compared to lower levels of vitamin D. And the mechanism seems to be that it helps control the calcium deposits in the body, keeps them out of the arteries and veins, and puts them in the hard tissues where they belong. From our studies, we're recommending that people should have serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels in the range of 40 to 80 nanograms per milliliter, and that's much higher than the 16 or 26 that most people have. That would take 2 to 5 to 7,000 IU per day, which is totally safe if you consider that going in the sun, you can make 10,000 IU. And had our ancestors not been able to tolerate 10,000, we wouldn't be here. The recommendation of 400 IU per day was made on the basis of rickets, and that was in 1997. There's a new committee meeting, and they will make their recommendations known in September, and we certainly hope they're going to be to 1 to 2,000 IU per day. Otherwise, we're going to point out that that's just unacceptable. My question, then, is do you have any way of testing the serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels in your former patients or your current patients, and could you maybe do a study to see if what the relation is?
We have not looked at that. It should not be very difficult to do.
Okay. Any other questions?
Has there been any research regarding conditioned vasodilation of the periphery, as in the case of protocols using biofeedback for Raynaud's syndromes, et cetera?
So vasodilation meaning trying to get the blood vessels to open up, and the history of that is a long one. You know, surgeons try treatments such as sympathectomy, which is to reduce the sympathetic nervous system outflow to the leg. And there are medications that are pretty effective at reducing the sympathetic nervous outflow and causing vasodilation. By and large, they have not been very effective, primarily because in most of these situations, the body is already pretty maximally trying to dilate its vessels. They're thirsty, you know, downstream from the blockage. That's not the case in all types of patients with Raynaud's, some patients with other forms of specific forms of vascular disease, but most patients with PAD are already pretty much auto-vasodilated. That's not the end of the story, though, because there is a lot still of there's a lot of pharmacology research going on to try to see if you can even produce more vasodilation. And there are some treatments such as spinal cord stimulation and compression boots. What's called the Artassist device. It's basically a compression boot on the leg that squeezes the leg intermittently. That does seem to have some effect on improving blood flow for reasons that are not entirely worked out. It may be that they actually enhance endogenous nitric oxide, which is a vasodilator. So I think that it's possible that inducing more effective vasodilation could have some effect on some patients. But the history of studying it with conventional medications has been relatively unsatisfactory so far.
You mentioned 80,000 amputations per year. I'm curious about the number of diagnoses of PAD per year. I may not have been paying attention, or maybe it wasn't on the slide.
No, I didn't talk about incidence. I talked about prevalence. I don't have good data about diagnosis. The best data that we have is cross-sectional prevalence. And it's done in studies where they applied the screening test as part of the study. And because people aren't all applying the screening test, which makes a diagnosis, the incidence is a little artificial. I think the best data we have comes from these studies that specifically brought all patients in to community institutions and applied the ABI test and just sampled a population. The only thing we know about incidence is the incidence of procedures, which is dramatically rising in the last decade because there is more technology, so people are treating more commonly at stages of disease that in the past we would perhaps monitor, and the outcomes of that are mixed. But we don't know about true disease incidence.
Okay, our thanks to Dr. Michael Conte for his comments here today. And now this meeting, the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.